No place for a child today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy for undocumented immigrants separated thousands of children from their parents. Now the administration is under pressure to reunite them. But even if they do, the families could end up in detention centers that resemble jails.
All of the lawyers who've worked with these families in these centers over the years, they all say this is no place for a child.
Also, the U.S.-born children of immigrants who struggle to prove their citizenship after their families move back to Mexico.
Whether they ever go to live in the United States is sort of irrelevant. They are U.S. citizens.
Plus, a reporter recalls meeting Coco.
I had never before and have never since been assigned to go interview a gorilla.
Remembering Coco and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on this Friday. Thank you for being here. So no matter how you feel about immigration, it has been a tough week of news. Stories and pictures of families separated at the border. Children sobbing, begging for their mothers and fathers. On Wednesday, President Trump signed an executive order ending the policy of family separation of undocumented immigrants, a policy that he himself had started. But that order is also asking the courts to let the government detain kids together with their parents indefinitely. Right now, there are only three detention centers that take families. Two are in Texas, one's in Pennsylvania. It's unclear if those are the centers where Trump is planning on sending the families or if that's the model he has in mind, but it seems likely it is. The World's Monica Campbell is here to talk about that question and other immigration news this week. Do you know anybody who's been to these places and what they're actually like inside?
I don't know personally people. Well, in all my years of reporting on immigration, I may have been in touch with people who've been in these detention centers at some point or another. But all this week, I've been talking to immigration lawyers who have worked with families in these detention centers since the beginning. And all of the lawyers who've worked with these families in these centers over the years, they all say this is no place for a family. This is no place for a child. They are essentially jails. You can't come and go as you want. I spoke to one attorney who works to this day with families at the Pennsylvania facility. And, you know, she was saying what we're hearing. Kids can't run around. They can't make noise. They can't go outside without a guard. And one thing that she told me that I found was really striking, and it's documented, is that at that facility in Pennsylvania, they do night checks throughout the night.
Meaning what?
Well, so there's six people to a room. So you might have two families bunking together in a room. They are under surveillance. There have to be bed checks. So what they do throughout the night is the guards come in with a flashlight every 15 minutes. And they shine flashlights in the rooms, in people's faces, on the ceilings. And the lawyers who work with these families say that the families are experiencing extreme sleep deprivation. The kids are traumatized by not being able to sleep. And I talked to an ICE spokesperson, and they acknowledge that that is a challenging type of environment. But how do you do this otherwise? You need to make sure the people are still there. This is the type of environment that a family is living in. And if the Trump administration has its way, we could see these types of conditions go on for months.
What are the alternatives to detention?
Well, one of the alternatives that's been used for years is allowing people out on bond, monitoring them through ankle monitors, and having people check in with immigration.
Yeah, and Republicans say people released with those ankle monitors actually don't show up for their hearings and those appointments. Is that true?
I heard that, and it's not true. It's absolutely not true. It's documented by the government's own data.
So just this week, Donald Trump said the U.S. will not be a migrant camp and it will not be a refugee holding facility. Then he signs his executive order, and now this. Do you think this is what Trump wanted to do all along, and did he do family separations to get us here?
Well, we did see language in the Republican bills, in the more hardline Republican bill, that asked for that flexibility about holding families and children in detention for longer periods of time, basically to waive what we're hearing a lot about. It's called the Flores settlement, right? We've talked about that in the week. So that would suggest that there is a desire to hold people in detention centers for longer periods of time. When you're in a detention center, it's really hard to fight your case, to get asylum, to make a phone call. I've been waiting all week to talk to a man from Guatemala in a detention center in Texas. His lawyer filled up a card with money for him to call me because, you know, I can't call him. I've been waiting all week to hear from this man. He has not called me. I know he wants to talk to me, and he can't because it's really hard to communicate. I mean, if you've ever been to a prison, you see how difficult it is for people to communicate to the outside world. Imagine trying to fight for asylum within that setting in another language with no lawyer. So if the Trump administration wants to keep people in detention and that's its goal, that's what it's trying to do here.
There are two immigration bills on Capitol Hill, both expected widely to fail. But when you speak with attorneys who represent some of these families, are they surprised that there's not more outrage coming from at least the Democrats? And what kind of support are they looking for from the Democrats that they're not getting?
I've talked to attorneys who've been working in immigration for years, and they've been working. They were working with families when Obama was cracking down and when we had a lot of kids alone in detention in 2014. And they said, one woman I spoke to said that she was shouting at the top of her lungs to anyone who would listen about, you know, we've seen the pictures of the kids in the, you know, they're called cages, right? And then people have found out, oh, those were from 2014. She said, I was sharing those images in 2014 and Democrats weren't listening. And she admitted, I voted for Obama. So there's a lot of internal searching and people who are Democrats themselves say they feel that Obama got a pass on a lot of this, that a lot of what Trump is doing is built on the foundation of what previous administrations laid out. And they're now seeing a lot of people in America become very interested in what is going on now. But we've been here before.
So we asked listeners to send in their questions, and one listener, Monica, asked, are there enough judges, attorneys, translators, and support staff in the nation willing to work with all these detained immigrants and asylum seekers? How do you see it?
Well, if you look at my inbox, there are a lot of cries for volunteers from legal NGOs and law associations, bar associations. The Texas Bar Association sent out a, you know, all points bulletin. We need Spanish speaking lawyers. This is also very similar to what we saw in 2014 when we saw pro bono lawyers and teams of volunteers go to the family detention centers and to also help the unaccompanied minors with legal representation. I was struck by a lawyer I spoke with yesterday. She's in Denver, and she was just distraught because she volunteered quite a bit in 2014. She worked 12-hour days, you know, renting a room at a hotel outside of one of these family detention centers with 200 volunteers. They were rotating through these detention centers trying to give families inside legal assistance and help because they knew they had cases. They knew they had asylum cases, and that if they didn't have any legal representation, they were going to lose their case and they're going to get deported. So the lawyer I talked to yesterday, she said, you know, I just want to be down there. I just want to be on the border. And she can't do that. She's got a kid and it's hard, but the call is out for volunteer lawyers, and I'm seeing it all over the place.
The World's Monica Campbell, thank you very much for the update.
You're welcome, Marco.
There's another kind of challenge facing some immigrant families. These are families with children born here in the U.S. By birth, whatever their parents' immigration status, these children are U.S. citizens. But what if they move back to their parents' country of origin and can't prove their U.S. citizenship later? It's estimated there are hundreds of thousands of such cases right now in Mexico alone. Reporter Emily Green brings us one family story.
In the tiny village of Chernastico, in the state of Michoacán, Yasmin Mendez Marquez and her mother, Cecilia Marquez, sit inside their house. The living room is empty, except for the three plastic chairs we sit in and a cardboard box with peeping chickens. Cecilia tells me she married at 14, not an uncommon practice in rural Mexico. Soon after, she and her husband moved to the U.S., to rural Georgia. He had a temporary visa to work in the agricultural fields.
Era un sueño. Trabajamos en la cebolla, a veces en el tabaco.
She says it was like a dream. They picked onions and sometimes tobacco. At 15, Cecilia gave birth to Yasmin. She shows me the birth certificate from the hospital.
I'm looking at the birth certificate. It says she was born in Bullock Memorial Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia, on June 25th, 1993.
The U.S. Constitution grants anyone born in the U.S. automatic citizenship. But problems for Yasmin started immediately. First, the hospital reversed the order of her last names. In Latin America, a newborn traditionally gets two last names, father's first, followed by mother's. But in her U.S. documents, Yasmin's mom's last name was listed first. This is a common mix-up, and it can cause big problems down the road. A year later, Cecilia returned to Mexico with Yasmin.
Nunca nos imaginamos, ¿verdad?, que cuando uno se viene acá a México, que uno le saca pasaporte a sus hijos.
Cecilia says it never occurred to her that before returning to Mexico, she needed to get a U.S. passport for Yasmin. Back in Chernastico, Yasmin's family tried to enroll her in school. But the school said Yasmin didn't have the proper documents. So the family lied and said she was born in Mexico, which allowed her to attend school. But now Yasmin has two different officially documented places of birth, the U.S. and Mexico. This happens a lot, says Ian Brownlee, who until recently was a consular official with the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City.
It should be a dying practice to have a false Mexican registration. It takes a long time for everybody to learn that, yeah, it's okay for a little Juancito to be a U.S. citizen and attend school in Mexico.
Brownlee says the embassy works diligently to sort out which documents are true and which are false. He says the hardest cases are when the kids were born in the U.S. but don't have a birth certificate because it was lost or it was a home birth and the parents never got one.
It is really one of our main priorities here at the moment is documenting these kids as U.S. citizens. Whether they ever go to live in the United States is sort of irrelevant. They are U.S. citizens.
President Trump has a different message, though. As a candidate, Trump claimed incorrectly that the U.S.-born kids of immigrants are not automatically American citizens, and he vowed to end the right to U.S. citizenship in such cases. Now, amid the Trump administration's crackdown on immigration, many undocumented Mexican families in the U.S. are afraid to ask for official government help to document their U.S. citizen kids. That's according to Juan Carlos Mendoza Sanchez, who heads a Mexican government agency dedicated to assisting Mexicans abroad.
Tienen miedo que al ir a los consulados, que ellos compartan su información.
Mendoza says people are afraid to ask for help, even from Mexican consulates, because they worry their personal information will be shared and lead to deportation. Yasmin, now 25, still lives in rural Mexico and hopes to get a U.S. passport. Regarding her conflicting paperwork, Mexican officials put her in touch with a pro bono lawyer 18 months ago. She says the lawyer hasn't done anything, and on her own, she's unable to navigate the bureaucracy.
Quiero conocer allá tengo a una de mis hermanas y nunca la he visto. Y yo la quiero conocer.
Yasmin says she wants to get to know the United States. She has a sister in Georgia she has never met, and she wants to get to know her too. Whether Yasmin will ever have a chance to visit the country of her birth is anyone's guess. For The World, Emily Green, Chernástico, Michoacán, Mexico.
Later on the show, this weekend women in Saudi Arabia get to drive. We've got some good news and the bad on that story coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's take a few minutes now for a remembrance. Maybe you've heard of Coco. She was perhaps the world's most famous gorilla, a Western lowland gorilla, to be precise. She was born 46 years ago at the San Francisco Zoo, and she died this week peacefully in her sleep at the Gorilla Foundation's Preserve in California. Coco was famous for communicating in American Sign Language, or ASL. It was said she knew over 2,000 words and was able to converse with humans. Cynthia Gorney, who now writes for National Geographic, met Coco back in 1985 on assignment for the Washington Post. Cynthia, thanks for being here. What was that meeting like with Coco?
It was really strange, Marco. I had never before, and have never since, been assigned to go interview a gorilla. And she lived with her longtime teacher, and I guess trainer would be the right word, Dr. Francine Patterson. And, you know, what can I tell you? She was a gorilla, 260 pounds. I showed up with my notebook and pen, as reporters do, very unclear about what the opening question with a gorilla ought to be. And she looked at me, I would say suspiciously, but I don't really know what suspicion looks like, honestly, in a gorilla. And then she made a gesture, kind of swiping her fist across her face. And Dr. Patterson looked really embarrassed and said, "Coco." And she looked at me and she said, "She just called you a toilet." And that was the first, and I will say last time, I have been insulted by a gorilla. She told me afterward that Coco swears, or Coco swore, R.I.P. Coco. Yeah.
There were some exchanges between you and Coco that were kind of poignant.
Well, the poignant exchanges were not actually between me and Coco. The reason for my visit in 1985 was that, famously, there had been a kitten in the Coco Dr. Patterson family, and Coco had apparently loved this kitten very much. And the kitten had been hit by a car and killed. And Dr. Patterson and the volunteers who worked with Coco had come to tell her that, as Dr. Patterson recalled to me during the interview, she did not use any words for death or killed, but she said All Ball, that was the name of the kitten, had been hit by a car and we won't be seeing her anymore. And part of the reason that this story got such widespread attention was that Coco's reaction was very intense. She was very quiet for a little bit and then she began a kind of hooting, which is, I gather, gorilla's way of keening. She was clearly in grief and everybody was crying and it was awful. She was not exhibiting any signs of grief that I was aware of when I was there, but, you know, I was not then and am not now a gorilla expert.
I mean, scientists have questioned how much Coco's communication really came from her and how much it was kind of projected onto her by researchers, perhaps by Dr. Patterson. What is your take on that?
Well, this is a big controversial area, not just with gorillas, but with other primates generally. There was a great deal of uneasiness about the claims that Dr. Patterson was making for Coco's level of communication, which in her view included 500 working signs, a vocabulary that Dr. Patterson said she had observed of like 1,000 working signs, Coco signing in ways that exhibited amusement, grief, boredom, all kinds of emotions. I've been thinking about this a lot since Coco died. And anybody who has ever loved an intelligent animal knows things that the animal is communicating. We know animals communicate grief. So the arguments about Coco and Dr. Patterson were really arguments that were more linguistic. What is the definition of language? Is Coco really using what we think of as language, or is she merely learning to mimic signs that Dr. Patterson had taught her? The principal criticisms leveled against the Coco-Patterson work were that she didn't publish scientifically. She didn't subject her work to peer review. When I asked her about that in 1985, she didn't deny that this was so, but she basically just said, "I don't have time. I'm taking care of this gorilla. I'm running this foundation." But it was also clear on some level this was an experiment that didn't quite go the way that scientists, and I would venture to guess Dr. Patterson, had hoped it would. And they were never able to get Coco to reproduce. So there was never any sense that whatever language Coco was using had been extended to other members of her gorilla family. And when I think back on my 3 hours or whatever it was there with Coco and Dr. Patterson, it was a remarkable experience. But there's something, to me personally, just as a regular human, not an animal specialist, there was something a little bit wrong about so much work being put into teaching an animal to communicate in what is clearly not that animal's first language. And whatever level of success Dr. Patterson and the volunteers had at giving Coco some fluency in sign language and thus human language, there's no question that I don't mean to get religious about it, that wasn't what Coco was put on the planet to use, right,
yeah,
for language.
You know, it's funny. If you're a reporter and you go do an animal story, chances are your work might not be seen as super relevant to the news cycle. You might get some eye rolls from your colleagues. Coco is obviously a different case. I'm curious, where did your interview with Coco rank in terms of assignments and its kind of long-term impact on you?
You can tell that I remember it pretty vividly.
Yeah.
And part of it is just among the interesting things I have been asked to do over the years, one of the most interesting was being asked to go and interview a gorilla, because that really was the nature. I was not sent out to do a story on primate language, which is, of course, what I turned in because I over-report everything. I was sent out to go and do an interview with a gorilla. And I remember my editors, when I came back, sighing deeply, saying like, okay, it's a story on primate language. We'll go with it. We wanted an interview with a talking gorilla. But I was moved and perplexed by it. My mother had been a fairly serious student of linguistics. I come from a multilingual family. I've never learned ASL, but I've always been kind of fascinated by the things that deaf people and people who are fluent in ASL can communicate that cannot be communicated in the same way with spoken language. So thinking about all of this while looking at this gorilla was very intense for me.
What would you say is Coco's legacy?
I would hope that Coco's legacy would be to make us think about the nature of language, the nature of communication. Do we really need to have verbs and so on be part of real language? Can language and species communication be just as fully realized by the kinds of emotional and visual cues that we all have with animals that we love? So I guess I would really hope that what people would remember about Coco is much less the controversy over whether her communication constituted language than the love that she stimulated clearly in the people who were directly around her and in the people who saw her on the videos and, you know, mugging with Robin Williams with his glasses and all that stuff that's viral this week.
Cynthia Gorney is a writer with National Geographic. She met Coco back in 1985. Cynthia, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. New populist leaders in Italy are pushing Europe to limit immigration, and this observer worries where that path might lead.
I understand that no country can have an open border, no country can accept all the applicants, you know, but in the long run, this will really damage the fabric of our societies.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The asylum system is broken, and political leaders need to fix it. That's the view of Amnesty International in a statement the human rights group issued today. But they're not talking about the U.S., although Amnesty has had sharp words for the U.S. this week. No, in this case, they're talking about Europe. Europe has accepted hundreds of thousands of migrants and asylum seekers from the Middle East and Africa over the last few years. But new governments in places like Austria and Italy are pushing back, and hard. Italy is turning away migrant rescue ships, and it wants the rest of Europe to take more of the migrants who've already landed there. European leaders are holding a summit on migration on Sunday. Gianni Riotta is a columnist with the Italian daily La Stampa. Let's start with what's happening in Italy, Gianni. Why are migrant rescue ships being turned away from Italian ports right now?
We have a new government. They joined together and made an issue of Italy cannot stand the migration waves anymore. To be sure, Italy was left alone tackling the migration issue for many years in the Mediterranean Sea by the European Union. The Italian Navy did heroic efforts to rescue thousands of lives. But the new government, you know, just is using this to raise hell with Europe. Very likely they want to blackmail Europe on the migration issue and then get some money and get some relief from that.
But let's add a dose of reality here, Gianni. The number of migrants arriving in Europe is way down from this time last year. So why are so many European politicians raising this hostility now, this year?
Because the public opinion, the European public opinion, is fed up with this. You see this in Germany, you see this in Austria, you see this even in France or in Great Britain.
Well, I mean, it's populists that seem to be pushing this agenda. The Italian Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, said today, we cannot take in one more person, even suggested sending some out. How popular is that sentiment there? And is it also divisive?
It's very popular. I guess it can even be in a majority of with a majority of Italians. But please make a note of what happened in the United States when President Trump tried to separate the kids from their families. And there is a strong anti-migrant sentiment in the United States. But eventually, even President Trump had to back off. I want to see Salvini when the next ship will sink or when there will be the next disaster. I don't see how can they can go on. I mean, the Italy I grew up in, I don't see this level of hatred to be sustainable in the long run in Italy. They are simply, you know, spewing too much bile in too few weeks. Sooner or later, they'll have to start tackling serious issues.
But what we're seeing is serious debates about immigration in Italy, in Germany, in Austria. What do you think is likely to come out of the European summit on Sunday?
You know, I don't know. I don't know because it's really difficult to understand how much hype, how much propaganda there is. I know that the Italian cabinet is split, but, you know, propaganda is a way of starting having a life of its own. I think that Salvini is pushing things too much. He's huffing and puffing, but I'm afraid that also him and the entire country can be a prisoner of these slogans. And at a certain time, Europe will call us to make a deal and will be isolated.
Finally, Gianni, I'm curious to know, since you've been reading the disturbing and tragic reports of families getting separated at the U.S. border, what similarities and differences you see between the U.S. and Europe when it comes to immigration?
You know, I see similarities because it is true that the United States absorb more immigrants every year than Europe. The problem is that I understand that no country can have an open border. No country can accept all the applicants. You know, I've been an immigrant twice in my life, in my own country, from the south to Rome, and then from Italy to the United States. So I know what it takes and what the kind of talk. But it's really disgusting to see politicians to use kids, to use families, in order to gain some votes. In the long run, this will really damage the fabric of our societies.
Yeah, in many respects, it's happening in many parts of the world.
Absolutely.
Gianni Riotta, columnist with the Italian paper La Stampa. Thank you, as always.
Thanks very much.
The big story in Turkey this weekend is that country's election. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is running for his fifth term as Turkey's leader, but he's not the only Erdogan on the ballot. There's another one running for parliament. The two candidates are not related. In fact, the other Erdogan came to Turkey from Syria, but he wants his name to make a statement. Fariba Nawa has the story from Bursa in northwest Turkey.
Mohammed Erdogan is 6 hours late for his meeting in a shiny construction office. He has three cell phones, and they keep ringing. His name used to be Mohammed El-Sheikhouni, but the 34-year-old businessman changed his name to Erdogan last year to demonstrate his loyalty to Turkey and to the Turkish president. As the only Syrian candidate running for Turkish parliament, this Erdogan says he has to keep proving that he's Turkish enough, even with his own party, the ruling AKP, and even though his own roots lie in Turkey.
Ben de Türk vatandaşıyım. Ailemin Suriye'ye göç etmesi beni farklı...
I am a Turkish citizen as well. My family immigrated from Turkey to Syria under the Ottomans. My grandparents were Turks.
More than 3 million Syrians live in Turkey now after fleeing the war at home. Mohammed Erdogan is one of about 55,000 Syrians granted Turkish citizenship since 2011 as part of a program to give citizenship to immigrants who bring exceptionalism to Turkey. Like President Erdogan, Mohammed Erdogan stresses that he's a practicing Muslim but not an Islamist. He says he believes in democracy, Turkey's secular constitution, and women's rights. He says he wouldn't interfere in his Turkish wife's decision to work outside or stay at home.
I wholeheartedly support women. Of course I do. Why? Women are always right.
Then he backtracks and says religion should play a role in the laws that govern marriage and divorce, for example, because Turkey is an Islamic country. Despite his love of Turkey, a lot of Turks don't view this Erdogan as a legitimate candidate because he's also Syrian. It doesn't help that his Turkish language skills are still a work in progress. In fact, he asked his Turkish assistant to write down his answers and correct any errors before I recorded him. In the weeks before the election, campaigning is loud with music blaring from trucks in public squares. Bursa is an AKP stronghold, but the opposition is visible here as well, with booths and wall-sized posters. Some recent polls suggest that incumbent President Erdogan may not get the majority of votes he needs to win outright, triggering a runoff on July 8th, but he has a lot of support here. Samet Bostan is a vendor here who sells photo frames. He's a staunch backer of President Erdogan and the AKP, and he also likes the president's namesake, Mohammed Erdogan, because he says the same things as the president. But others here, like Hava Kurtuluş, are skeptical of a Syrian-born Erdogan.
He shouldn't be supported. I've been an AKP voter for 15 years now. As far as I know, shouldn't a member of parliament be a person that is born on this land and someone who knows everything about this country?
Actually, no. Parliamentary candidates just have to be Turkish citizens and endorsed by one of the parties. But the large numbers of Syrians who have settled here since 2011 have led to a backlash. Some Turks say they're taking their jobs, hurting the economy, and changing the culture. Hidayet Savinç is a member of the newly formed E Party.
We're a party who believes that Syrians should go back. We're the only party who voices this out loud and clearly. The Syrians will be happy in their own country. I disapprove of a Syrian being an MP in the Turkish parliament. He doesn't even speak proper Turkish.
Mohammed Erdogan says some Syrians will go back when it's safe again and the country gets back on its feet, but others will stay. His goal, he says, is to serve Turkey and its diverse population. For the world, Fariba Nawa, Bursa, Turkey.
So this happened this week.
Let's go! Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star.
Carpool karaoke from James Corden's late night show on CBS. Corden was in Liverpool, UK for this one, and that's Paul McCartney singing with him. Now, I doubt they had Saudi Arabia on their minds when they wheeled out that Beatles classic. But a couple of months ago, both that country and that song were on my mind. That's because Saudi Arabia was on the verge of allowing women to drive for the first time ever. And I thought the moment deserves a song. So I called up my best contact at Berklee College of Music here in Boston. And I asked him if he knew of any Middle Eastern students who could give Drive My Car the Makam treatment and maybe even rewrite the song in Arabic. Yeah, I know, no small order, but you'd be surprised what can happen at a place like Berklee. That is just a little taste of what they came up with, but before we hear more, let's meet the musicians. We pulled together a talented group of students on kanun, the first instrument you heard, Tony Barhoum, who's Palestinian, Tariq Rantisi, also Palestinian, on percussion, Laith Siddiq performs on violin, he's Jordanian, and Jared Henderson from Oregon on bass. Also,
Nasim Al-Atrash, cellist, composer, and arranger.
Nano Reyes, singer, composer, songwriter.
Nano Reyes is from Syria. She fled the fighting in Homs a few years ago. Nasim, the arranger and bandleader, is Palestinian. All these folks are Berklee students. For Nano and Nasim, the project seemed a little bizarre, although a little less so for Nasim, who'd kind of got obsessed by the Beatles when his home in the occupied territories finally got internet access a few years ago.
Yeah, I remember when we first got internet, I was maybe 11, 12, and I was so excited about just like hacking the phone of the house and going online. And when YouTube first came out, I was, as a musician, I was always on YouTube. And I remember the song I heard first was Hey Jude. And throughout my teenage years, it was one of my favorite tracks. Until now, I still love that song.
Drive My Car, though, may be an odd choice for Saudi women who'll finally be free to drive their cars. The lyric goes, ask a girl what you want it to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I want to be famous, a star on the screen, but you can do something in between. Baby, you can drive my car. Here's singer Nano Reyes.
When I heard it at first and I read the words, I thought, oh, that's very sexist and all of that. And then when I read the real meaning, yeah, it's, of course, it's nice. It's not sexist, at least.
True. The woman in the song is actually empowered. She's telling the guy what she wants him to do for her. But our version needed a different point of view, and the vocalist needed to be the woman herself.
What is this song called in Arabic?
It's called Rahsu' al-Sayyara.
And that translates as what?
I will drive the car.
It's a statement of fact.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Here's bandleader Nasim Al-Atrash again.
For the translation to the song, I feel like it's a very simple, funny, kind of goofy message. And the main idea is that this female who's singing just got the ability to drive. She's really excited. And at this moment of her life, she really doesn't care about anything else. She's getting all these proposals from different men. They're promising her all these things. But she's like, at the moment, I just want to drive. And maybe later I will love you. Maybe later I will think about these things. But at the moment, I just want to drive this car.
So Nasim, Nano, and the band came into our performance studio here at WGBH, and they laid down the track. I'm going to step in here during these solos, and don't worry, we've got the whole song online. For bandleader Nasim Al-Atrash, the moment captured in this song really is a big deal.
For me, as a Palestinian, I grew up with this longing for peace and longing for freedom. I've never in my life experienced freedom before coming to the U.S. and experiencing what it feels like to actually be able to drive somewhere without being stopped and asked for certain documentation. And driving a car is a basic thing to live in dignity. Some obstacles in the Middle East, they're coming from outside influence. But some are problems that we have to face and we have to solve on our own. And it always starts from within. So I believe that it's a very important and very big moment for Saudi Arabia and hopefully for the entire region.
We never came up with a name for this band, so I'm calling them Nano and the 624 in honor of the date this Sunday when Saudi women finally take the wheel. We've got the video at PRI.org, and a very big thanks to the world's own engineer, Robin Moore Jenkins, who recorded and mixed the track. Just before the break, we were talking in a somewhat celebratory way about the fact that starting on Sunday, women in Saudi Arabia will finally be allowed to drive. It is a big change, but it comes with some irony. That's because a group of Saudi activists who fought for years for rights like women driving will be watching this on Sunday from behind bars. They've been held in detention for the past month or so. The world's Shirin Jafari has been following the story. What is the latest, Shirin?
The short answer, Marco, is that most of these detainees are still behind bars. The arrest, you might remember, began last month and has been ongoing. Some of the detainees have been released, but we know that at least 9 of them are still under arrest. Back in May, when all this began, the Saudi media published the photos of these women's rights activists and accused them of being traitors and helping and supporting enemies of the kingdom.
So tell us about one of these activists.
There are several very prominent activists in this group. They come from different generations. One, for example, is about 70 years old. Another, Lujain Al-Hathloul, is about 28 years old. So from different backgrounds and generations. But let me tell you about one of them that I didn't know about. Her name is Nouf Abdelaziz. She's a women's rights activist and a journalist. She was arrested about 2 weeks ago. The police raided her home in Riyadh and took her to an unknown location. She's been held incommunicado since then. One Saudi writer I have been in touch with pointed me to a letter that Nouf wrote before she was arrested. It turns out that Nouf sort of anticipated her own arrest. She probably knew that speaking out against the wave of arrests would get her in trouble, and she wrote this letter to be published in case she was arrested.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable that she had the forethought to think about that. How did the letter actually get out?
Another women's rights activist, Maya Al-Zahrani, published the letter on her blog, which then led to her own arrest.
What does Nouf actually say in this letter?
She laments the way she's been treated by the Saudi government. She says she's not a criminal, she's not a terrorist, she's not a traitor. She writes, and I'm quoting here, "I'm a daughter to a great mother who suffers because of me," meaning, you know, the work that she does.
Yeah.
Then she poses this question. She asks, why is our homeland so small and why am I considered a criminal or an enemy that threatens it? You really get a sense from reading her letter that she feels betrayed by her own country, a country that she says she loves and she holds dear.
What does all this mean, Shirin, for the big day on Sunday when the driving ban in Saudi Arabia is actually lifted?
I think for a lot of women, this is a moment they feel excited about. But they also have reservations. For example, some women worry about how they're going to be treated on the road by other men. You know, they wonder if the society is ready for women behind the wheels. But at the same time, thousands of women have signed up to get driving lessons. And these lessons, interestingly, Marco, cost 6 times more than what men pay. Saudi officials say this is because the training for women is more comprehensive. I don't know what that means. But let me just add that there are 6 driving schools for women in the kingdom, and these are stationed inside university campuses. And if a woman gets behind the wheels in Saudi before Sunday, she'll be fined 900 riyals. That's about $200.
Wow, almost like officials don't want women to drive. Those fines aside, it's happening on Sunday. The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks so much for telling us about this.
No problem, Marco.
Finally today, there's this little soccer tournament going on in Russia right now. You may have heard of it, the Men's World Cup. And hoo boy, we've got some major drama to talk about. The world's soccer-obsessed editor, William Troop, is keeping a close eye on the games, to say the least. I kind of had to rip you away from your laptop to do this little
yes,
update. And we've got just a couple of minutes, William. But what has been the most dramatic thing so far at the World Cup?
Oh, my gosh. Has to be yesterday's game between Croatia and Argentina. Argentina going in as favorites, but Croatia trounced Argentina 3-0. And the drama began with Argentina's goalkeeper made an absolute horrible mistake. He just gifted the ball to a forward of the other team, and Croatia just easily went up.
Wow.
And the look of anguish and horror on the face of this poor goalkeeper and all the Argentina fans in the stands, I mean, talk about drama.
So Argentina is on the verge of being eliminated.
Yep.
I mean, Lionel Messi, one of the greatest in the world. And they were among the favorites.
Well, people forget that Argentina had to struggle to actually make it to the World Cup. They had to wait till their last qualifying game in South America. And what pulled them through in that occasion to make it to Russia was Lionel Messi had a great game. It did not happen yesterday for Messi and Argentina, and the result is that they're like a whisker away from elimination.
Giants could tumble. So based on what you've seen so far, who are your favorites?
Well, I really like one of the teams that's lived up to the hype so far is Belgium. Their first game, they looked really good. And then there's other teams like Portugal, Spain, Germany, even France. They're not looking so great, but I would rank them as well. And then let's just mention the team that has scored the most goals so far in this World Cup, Russia.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they are not favored at all. They have a weak team, but they've scored 8 goals in 2 games, so watch out. They could go far.
Can you dope a ball?
Well, you're not supposed to. I'll just leave it at that.
So are there any teams already out at this point?
Yes, sadly. It's already curtains for teams like Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Costa Rica, because each of those teams has lost their first two games, and so they have no chance at all anymore. You can also say the same for Egypt, which was a sentimental favorite for many people because they have their star player, Mo Salah. We've talked about him on the show before. Yep. He's a forward who plays in England. He's by far the player who's had the best year in world soccer. But he came into this tournament injured, and he just couldn't help Egypt do anything in those first two games. So Egypt is going home.
Yeah, shame for Egypt and Mo Salah and all Egypt fans. Yeah. What are you excited to watch this weekend, William?
I'm just going to mention one game. I didn't mention Mexico among the favorites before, but they have had a great start to the tournament. They beat Germany, the World Cup holders. Now, tomorrow, they play against South Korea. And it's kind of a litmus test. Was that result against Germany the result of some real greatness happening on the Mexico team, or was it just lucky? You know where I stand. Mexico is my team in this tournament, so I'm rooting for Mexico, and that's tomorrow, and I'm going to be watching that.
All righty. Go Mexico. That's the world.
Si se puede.
Okay, that's the world's very excited soccer guy, William Troop. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome.
All righty. Must-see World Cup TV action this weekend. It sounds like I know where I'll be tomorrow. That is our show for this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Taking off for a little R&R, Carol Hills will be with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.